From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. Some extraordinary events today. Donald Trump Jr. has tweeted out what he says is the entire email chain sent to him offering Russian aid to incriminate Hillary Clinton. The offer included information from, quote, the Crown Prosecutor of Russia that, quote, would incriminate Hillary and her dealings with Russia and would be very useful to your father. To which Trump Jr. responded, "If that's what you say, I love it." The New York Times had also obtained the messages and published its story just minutes after Donald Trump Jr.'s tweet. So joining us to unpack all of this is NPR lead politics editor Domenico Montanaro. Hi there, Domenico.
Hey there.
So the email chain that Donald Trump Jr. tweeted out today begins on June 3rd of last year. And the first email in the chain says the information he's promised is, quote, obviously very high level and sensitive information, but is part of Russia and its government's support for Mr. Trump. I mean, it seems rather astonishing. What is going on here?
It's pretty straightforward, and it's amazing that that didn't raise any red flags for Donald Trump Jr. Or we should also note, as you read through these emails, that these emails were forwarded to Jared Kushner, Trump's son-in-law and now senior advisor, and to the campaign chairman, Paul Manafort. So it raised no red flags for them, and all three still took this meeting.
So what do you think we'll unpack a little bit more of what's actually said in this, but what are the implications here for Trump Jr., for Jared Kushner?
Yeah, well, first we should say, as far as what's more in these emails, you know, it shows that Donald Trump Jr. knew that he would be meeting with a Russian government attorney, or that he was told anyhow that that's what he would be doing, and that the information he'd be receiving would incriminate Hillary Clinton and be, quote, very useful to your father. The individual who sent this along is a man by the name of Rob Goldstone, who's a music promoter and a former British tabloid journalist who had said that he was actually willing to send this directly to his father. It didn't seem that there was much of a potential filter there. He said that he would forward it to Rona, which is Trump's personal assistant for many years. Don Jr. said, no, you know, I'll handle it from here, but brought along high-level people within the campaign, the highest level within the campaign. And he had actually said, if it's what you say, I love it, especially later in the summer, especially because that was right during the heat of the general election campaign about to take place with Hillary Clinton. And we should note that Rob Goldstone is somebody who Donald Jr. met at a Miss Universe pageant that Donald Trump Sr. was putting on in Moscow in 2013. And he has connections to a very wealthy family. He's a promoter for Emin Agalarov, whose father, Aris Agalarov, is someone who Trump Sr. was looking to go into business with to put up a Trump Tower in Moscow. And he gave them the Miss Universe pageant. So all of this wound together intricately in some of Trump's financial dealings.
It's rather astonishing. I mean, Donald Trump Jr. in this tweet that contains the email chain also had a statement in which he says, to everyone, in order to be totally transparent, I'm releasing the entire email chain. Yeah. The information they suggested they had about Hillary Clinton, I thought was political opposition research. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, there are ongoing investigations into Russian interference in the campaign and potential collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia. I mean, how might this affect that?
Well, that statement either shows his naivete or malevolence because, you know, this is not how campaigns operate. If you get something from a foreign government or official, you should immediately be skeptical. Al Gore campaign officials had noted that they had something mailed to them of a binder of opposition research on George W. Bush that they didn't know where it came from. It appeared to be somewhat sketchy, and they turned it over to the FBI. This did not even raise flags, and they knew exactly where the information would be coming from for Donald Trump Jr. So, you know, this is the kind of thing that is going to raise the eyebrows of someone like Robert Mueller, the former FBI director who is now the special prosecutor in charge of the investigation, special counsel now in charge of the investigation into Trump campaign ties to Russia. And, you know, Donald Trump has tweeted 9 different times since May that there's no collusion. He's called it a hoax. He's said that it's a fraud. And it's notable that his lawyer, his personal lawyer, put out a short statement last night saying that Donald Trump Sr. did not know or approve of this meeting. Whether or not that's true remains to be seen.
Now, Domenico, we also know, of course, that the New York Times had obtained these emails. They published their story today, again, just a couple of minutes after Donald Trump Jr. tweeted it out.
And that's likely the reason why Donald Trump Jr. put out all of his emails.
Yeah, but I was just going to ask you, he's responding to the Times here, but why would he put them all out? I mean, there's some pretty incendiary stuff in here.
To get inside the mind of a man is somewhat problematic and troublesome. So I'm not going to try to assess his state of mind and why he did it. He likely wanted to get out ahead of the story and have his side of it all out there first. But I'll tell you that investigators are looking at this now, as is the Senate Intelligence Committee, wondering whether or not this goes beyond obstruction of justice, as Tim Kaine said, and raised the specter of whether or not this is treason.
NPR lead politics editor Domenico Montanaro, thank you so much, Domenico.
Thank you.
Well, it has been a dizzying few days. Let's step back and take a look through the eyes of an historian, Julian Zelizer, a political historian at Princeton University, a CNN political analyst, and a friend of Here and Now, been here quite some time. Julian, you join us from the NPR studios in New York. Have you ever seen anything like this?
Well, I think today is one of those moments where you have historians scratching their heads, trying to think of what this is like. Obviously, with any major investigation, as we had with Watergate, there are shocking revelations, sometimes that take place during hearings, like what happened with Watergate, but nothing quite like this. Nothing like the principals in the scandal tweeting out information that appears, at least, to be the most damaging material that is out there.
And as I said, it's been dizzying. So let's remind ourselves, when this meeting itself was first revealed by the New York Times, Donald Trump Jr. said that it was to hear about adoption policies. Then once there were three sources who said that an email showed that it was about getting negative information on Hillary Clinton, he said it was about getting negative information on Hillary Clinton. And now we have well, I don't know if it's the final shoe, but the revelation that it was information that came as part of Russia and its government support for Mr. Trump, ongoing support. And this was just days after this, Donald Trump Jr. was asked to answer a charge from Democrats that Russians were involved in the election because the DNC emails had been leaked. And he was asked about this on CNN, the fact that Russians might be involved. And he said, it's lies, lies. It's disgusting. Julian, I mean, you can't help but think about another time in history when it wasn't, you know, the crime, it was the cover-up. Your thoughts on, we now know in an email, he knew the Russians were involved, and days later he said that wasn't true.
No, absolutely. That refrain obviously comes from how Nixon handled the investigation. And in this case, the administration doesn't really have much credibility left. You know, every statement that it makes is then contradicted. Information is constantly withheld from the public. And people, even Republicans, don't really know what's coming next or what to believe. And there's a lot of evidence that members of the administration are working hard to prevent investigators and the media from knowing exactly what happened. And so that raises suspicions. Although in this case, I do think the crime itself still is front and center. And that's why these emails are so disconcerting, given what we know Russia was doing in this election. Well, I think in some ways there's a double whammy here.
Well, meaning what? The crime is front and center because we just heard the T word mentioned. Some people are saying treason. Others are pointing to laws that say that you can't get something of value from a government agent or you can't conspire against, you know, the United States. These are, you know, laws that are in place. What are you seeing?
Well, that's the question. The question here is, did the Trump campaign collude with the Russian government either directly or through multiple contacts to win the election? And now today you hear the word treason uttered by the former Democratic vice presidential candidate, which takes the accusation to the, you know, place where this always could go. And so that's the allegation. That's the suspicion. And these emails that he just released, I don't think really seem to help his case.
Well, others are pointing to something else that seems to be illustrated in these emails, which we should say were written to Trump Jr. by a former business associate of his father's in Russia, who may be completely inflating what he had there. Mm-hmm. He may be making this up, that it came from, you know, Russian officials. But on the face of it, he's talking about an ongoing Russia government support for Mr. Trump, his father. And Donald Trump Jr. doesn't express any surprise at that. You know, what do you mean there's an ongoing plan to support my father? Is that kind of damning in your eyes?
It is. I mean, and I do think it's important. We have to understand what the documents are. And I'm sure all the investigators look at the documents with a certain level of suspicion. So we understand the context and where they come from. But yes, I think part of what makes the emails troubling is the tone. There is no surprise. There is excitement. And this doesn't appear to be an official in a campaign who is either pushing back or who doesn't know where any of this is coming from. There's a comfort and familiarity in the email exchange, which is going to be a problem. And again, if the administration had more credibility, it would be easier to respond.
Julian Zelenzer, a political historian at Princeton, CNN political analyst, author. We'll link you to his works at hearnow.org. Julian, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Is there anything that says summer more than basil? In fact, it's often referred to as the king of herbs. And here in our resident chef, Kathy Gunst, has been exploring its possibilities. Lucky us, she's in the studio. Kathy, we have been to your garden, and it's filled with basil, but different kinds. Remind us, there's different kinds of basil.
Oh, there's so many different kinds. Well, you know, we could actually start. Being so patient, not diving into the food. I'm super impressed. So on this plate, this leaf is your basic. It's not so basic, but this is what you call sweet basil.
Pale green, what you think you see when you see
exactly.
Basic basil.
It's also different varieties are called Genovese, Napolitano, Italian large leaf. Do the aromatherapy. Just like run your fingernail on it.
Sorry, people.
It smells like summer, right?
Yeah.
It's just like you feel the warmth of the sun on you. You can hear the waves at the beach. It's just everything good about summer. Next to it, these are ruffled green basil. And it is literally called that. They're called lettuce leaf or ruffled basil. Similar flavor profile, but really
sharper.
Fun looking. A little bit sharper, but they're really fun with the ridges and the lettucey type. This purple leaf here, this is called shiso or Japanese basil. It's also called perilla. I adore this. This is all over my garden. Once you grow it, it's like a weed. And this is what you often see in sushi rolls. Isn't that
It's fabulous? More licorice-y.
Exactly, Robin.
Thank
it's,
you.
All basil are members of the mint family, and shiso is as well. It pairs really well with cucumbers and ginger and soy and rice dishes. And you will often see it, particularly with eel and sometimes with tuna, shiso leaf. Okay. Great thing to grow. And then this other little tiny baby leaf, this is called bush basil because it's so little and it grows in a little bush.
It's like a quarter of an inch.
Yeah, and they're just adorable and you can sprinkle them. But you should also keep your eyes open for something called dark opal basil, deep purple leaves. They get a white flower on them. Excellent to add to pestos and bruschetta and different pasta dishes. Tulsi, or holy basil, is a revered plant in the Hindu religion. It's also called sacred basil and it's often dried and used to make tea because it's a great immune booster.
Well, that was all very informative. Can we eat?
I'm sorry. I have so many more. Can I give a plug to one more
Please.
Of my favorite basils? Start eating. Lemon basil. I adore this. It's got a super bright lemony flavor. Really good in salads, in different sauces. Again, add a bit to a pesto. Delicious in mayonnaise with seafood. Okay, food. I'm sorry. I kept you waiting.
That's all right.
Let's start with the soup. This is my summer tomato and basil soup.
Wow.
You use the freshest, ripest, plumpest, bursting with flavored tomatoes. You saute some onions or leeks. You add the peeled tomatoes. You whirl it up with some vegetable or chicken stock. But what is on top of that, Robin, is a homemade basil oil. So you see the little droplets.
I was just
going to
say, there's oil rising up.
That's the basil oil. So there's basil in the soup at the beginning of the soup. You put basil in towards the end, and then you pop little droplets of this basil oil on top. So you're getting the basil in three different forms.
How do you make the basil oil?
So I'm happy you asked me that because it is so easy. And if you see it in gourmet food stores, it's often very expensive. Here's what you do. Fill a mason jar with a cup of olive oil. Add half a cup of basil leaves, making sure that they're pushed down and the oil is covering all the basil. Seal it up tight, and then I put it either outside or on a very sunny windowsill for at least a few hours or overnight. Strain it and you have this beautiful
wow.
herb-infused basil oil that you can use on pasta and grilled fish and in this delicious summer and basil
wonderful.
Soup.
Wonderful. Okay, moving on here.
Okay, how about, all right, the salad. Mm-hmm. So caprese salad is a very classic Italian salad. You see it everywhere. Mm-hmm. It combines mozzarella, tomatoes, and basil. So I thought, what could be different with this? Mm-hmm. So I took cherry tomatoes and I roasted them for an hour very slowly with lots of fresh oil and some of that basil oil. You can use slices of fresh mozzarella or mozzarella balls, which you can find in cheese shops mm. and the grocery store. And I marinated the mozzarella in the basil oil with fresh basil. And then I surround the whole thing with fresh basil leaves.
Summer
on a plate, right?
You can slice up your mozzarella ball with slices of tomato and some basil or pesto. But this, I mean, this is just...
It's just, you know what it is? It's a notch above. Mm-hmm. It's just taking a caprese salad and kind of elevating it. Mm-hmm. You bring out the essence of those tomatoes by roasting them. Mm-hmm. The mozzarella takes on the basil, and the basil oil infuses the whole thing.
Okay.
And then these are so much fun. I had all this basil from my garden, and I thought, what if you use the leaf as the bowl or the container. So I took a basil leaf.
Such wacky thoughts, Kathy Gunst.
I am wild in the summer. And then I took goat cheese and I mixed it with some fresh basil and dill and chives, put that into the basil leaf, added some toasted hazelnuts and fresh tomato. Pop that in your mouth. It's a one bite. Kind of imagine that with some Prosecco, a cold beer, an iced tea.
Mm.
It's a perfect little bite, huh? She can't talk.
How did you even think hazelnut?
I knew I needed crunchy. Pine nuts are about $100 for two pine nuts these days. And I love hazelnuts. They're so nutty and buttery.
Could you try that in pesto? Hazelnut?
Why not? Of course. You can go nuts in pesto. You can use all different types of basil, almonds, pistachio, walnuts, hazelnuts. And then that little bit of juicy red tomato on those basil leaves. It's such a fun summer hors d'oeuvre, and I kid you not, it is 5 minutes of your time.
You know what I love to do with basil? Get it and just put it in some water on your windowsill like flowers.
Well, that is one of the great ways to keep it, actually. Many people say that that is the way to keep it the longest. Some people cover it in a plastic bag, which is not very attractive. If you have a lot of basil, I would urge you to put it in a food processor or a blender with olive oil and put it into an old-fashioned ice cube tray. And then you can pop it out all winter long and you get this blast of fresh summer basil with your olive oil. And it's a great way to preserve it.
Ah. Here Now Resident Chef Kathy Gunst. We'll have all of her ideas and recipes at hereandnow.org. Kathy, pleasure as always.
Thank you, Robin.
40 years ago, President Jimmy Carter awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom posthumously to Martin Luther King Jr. The civil rights icon had been assassinated 9 years earlier. Sean Powers of Georgia Public Broadcasting takes us back to that day at the White House with this audio postcard.
When I was a child in Georgia, there was another threat which afflicted us, and that was racial discrimination, a deprivation of human freedom, and a prohibition against the realization of the American dream for black people.
Selma sprang overnight from an obscure southern town to the front pages of world newspapers. This church was headquarters in the Negro drive for the right to vote. And it was here that Martin Luther King came to lend his support to the campaign.
As you may know, the Medal of Freedom is the highest civilian award that's given in our country. There are many Americans who do great things, who make us proud of them and their achievements, and who inspire us to do better ourselves. But there are some among those noble achievers who are exemplary in every way.
I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal.
The President of the United States of America awards this Presidential Medal of Freedom to Martin Luther King, Jr. Martin Luther King, Jr. was the conscience of his generation.
We shall overcome.
I'd like to ask Coretta King and Dr. Martin Luther King Sr. to come and stand beside me.
For us as a family and the millions in our nation who believed in Martin Luther King Jr.'s teaching, we are greatly encouraged and feel this action is indicative of the new spirit of reconciliation which you and your administration are causing in this nation. Thank you, Mr. President, for renewing our hopes that our nation can rise to true greatness and give due honor to one of its greatest national heroes.
I was born by the river in a little tent. Oh, and just like the river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long
time. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land.
It's been a long time coming, but I know.
Your 2017 Home Run Derby champion.
Sound from ESPN last night as Aaron Judge, a New York Yankees rookie, completed a performance for the ages, winning the Home Run Derby in Miami in towering fashion. And when we say towering, we mean 47 home runs. And according to Sports Illustrated, those round trippers traveled a combined 3.9 miles. Mike Pesca is here now as sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. And Mike, your thoughts on Aaron Judge's performance last night?
Well, every year there has to be a home run winners, but I think this year, in the embodiment of Aaron Judge, he's kind of symbolizing where baseball is now. And baseball is very home run centric. They're on the pace to set a record for most home runs. And this guy, Aaron Judge, he is a rookie. He is a Yankee. He is one of the few bright things about the Yankees. They're having a winning record, but they've lost a bunch in a row. And he just attracts the right kind of attention for the sport. He's 6'7". He's gigantic. Someone tweeted that it is if Zeus came down from Olympus and decided to swat some dingers. So this is a compelling guy. It's why you have a home run derby. An exhibition like this is to showcase a guy like Aaron Judge.
And talk about swatting. We said that a combined 3.9 miles, but like some of his individual home runs crushed them. How far did they go?
Yeah. Well, he had a couple that were over 500 feet, and this year he is responsible for the furthest home runs, the fastest home runs, and this is all in game play, not when a pitcher is just grooving them for the purpose of being hit, sometimes over a horrid sculpture in center field at Marlins Park. Unfortunately, he did not disable the sculpture in center field. That would have been a boon for everyone who's a fan of aesthetics, but he did his job.
So I love the image of Greek gods tossing lightning bolts around baseball stadiums. But I also hear that people, you know, it's exciting, but then after the home run's been hit, they tend to drift away from their televisions.
Well, yeah. I mean, the baseball has a pretty good All-Star game. They're doing what they can to turn 3 days into, it used to just be a day off, and then the All-Star game, and then another day off. So they're turning it into a spectacle. Traditionalists will grouse that, you know, these are the only games that aren't even counted in the standings. But what is baseball? What is sports if not an exhibition or a fun attraction? So this is an attraction of an attraction. I don't get upset about it. I just think it's, especially when Judge is doing it, compelling.
So we're getting very meta here about baseball. That's all right. But tell me more about Judge. He's got a really interesting and terrific life story, right?
Yeah. By the way, he won the home run derby in college, and he is a, like I said, he's gigantic. He's 6'7". So when you see him, you say to yourself, well, that looks like a very strong man. And certainly he is. I'll quote a the guy is going to be the rookie of the year in the National League, most likely. Cody Bellinger congratulated him on Twitter, saying, congrats at the Judge 44. You hit balls really far. I think that says it best, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, so he's going to be a starter for the American League. I mean, do you have any predictions on how it might go?
It's very hard to know who's going to win. The Las Vegas lines on the All-Star game are always, you know, it reflects that it is something of a crapshoot. And the reason is, even if one roster seems to have better players, the players do not play that often. It is an exhibition. The managers try to rotate the players through. So the American League lineup is stock full of Astros, but they'll probably come out after a few innings. And so sometimes it just comes down to who the best subs are.
Mm. Mike Pesca, Here Now sports analyst. Thanks so much, Mike.
Vacations can be a way to get away from it all, but if there's a book you want to take with you, Gail Forman's Leave Me recently came out in paperback. It's also about getting away from it all, but it's the hard way. Leave Me centers around Mary Beth Klein, an overcommitted 44-year-old mother of twins, barely balancing family and a job, and her husband Jason, who depends on her. Mary Beth does not feel well, but she's got to get to her accountant's office with those late tax returns. Then she really doesn't feel well, but how can she go to the doctor, the school? Firmly tells her there is no aftercare. You have to pick up the kids. Well, she finally gets to the hospital where the doctor tries to tell her, what, she needs surgery or something? Mary Beth explains, she has too much to do.
In the coming days, someone had to get the kids to their ballet classes, their soccer clinics, their speech therapy sessions, their play dates, their birthday parties, to take them shopping for their Halloween costumes, to the pediatrician for their flu shots, to the dentist for their cleanings. Someone had to plan the meals, pay the bills, balance the checkbook. Someone had to get it all done while still getting all the work done. Mary Beth sighed. It's just I have a house full of 4-year-olds and a very busy weekend. He stared at her for a long moment, frowning. Mary Beth looked back, disliking him already, and that was before he said, "You do realize you've had a heart attack."
Gail Forman, reading from her novel, Leave Me. We spoke with Gail when the book was first published. It is personal for her.
Well, yes, the idea of it came about 5 years ago when I was on a family vacation with my 2 young daughters and my husband and our friends with their kids the same age. And it was this really wonderful vacation. We were at the beach and the girls were doing cartwheels out on the lawn and we're having these communal meals together, except that I'm hiding upstairs with my cell phone trying to get a signal to Google heart attack symptoms and when it's so bad, you should call the ambulance. And it wasn't just complete hypochondria. My mother had bypass surgery when she was 48. And it was kind of a shock to us all because she didn't have any of the risk factors aside from apparently some bad genetic luck.
Right.
And so it's always been in the back of my mind. And as I waited to, I didn't call an ambulance, which is very stupid. And people should actually call if they're in that situation. But when I finally saw a doctor and had a stress test while I was waiting for that to all happen, I was imagining, what if I did need the surgery that my mother had. It's a brutal surgery. And I had these 2 young kids. And who was going to take care of them? Because I worked from home and I was the default mom. And who was going to take care of me? And that terrified me. And it also made me angry. Mm-hmm. And I think I started the book really as a revenge fantasy, this idea of this mother who has a heart attack and in the aftermath, nobody's taking care of her and she runs away from home. Eventually, I went to the cardiologist and it was not my heart and the urgency sort of withered away. But then I picked up the book about 3 years later and Mary Beth was there very much as a character, but it took on a different dimension, you know, beyond the sort of revenge fantasy cri de coeur of the working mom.
Right. And it sure did, because you had another element. I want to get to that, but she, you know, people just heard you say, she what? She runs away from home. And here's where we wander into Kramer versus Kramer territory. That's the late 70s movie that shocked people because, you know, a notion that a mom, played by Meryl Streep, would abandon a dad, played by Dustin Hoffman, to go off and, well, we don't really know what she did.
Right.
Because your book is from the mom's point of view and that movie was from the dad's. Did you think of that, Kramer versus Kramer?
Absolutely. I mean, I thought of it in a lot of ways. I wondered if that movie would even get made today, number one. And number two, yes, absolutely, because you are with the father and you are with the son, and Meryl Streep seems very cold, and it all seems so incredibly selfish. At least that's what my childhood recollections of the film was, and I didn't want to rewatch it while I was working on the book. And here, I'm hoping that people, even if they find Mary Beth's actions unforgivable or shocking, they're also somewhat relatable and they're sympathetic to her.
You've added another layer. You talk about being conscious of your mom and that that affected how you thought about your health. And so you were thinking about a possible heart attack because your mom had had one. You give us a character, Mary Beth, who's adopted and has no idea what her genes are.
Right. Has no idea and has told herself throughout her life that she doesn't really care and she doesn't need to kind of pull on that thread. But then when she has this heart attack, she's very – she doesn't understand how could this have happened. Did I do something wrong? And there's almost a need to find out, was there a genetic component? Although, you know, in the end, I don't think that's truly why she goes looking for her birth mother.
Well, she leaves an email at home with her husband saying, I've had it. And by the way, you mentioned briefly – I just want to fill it out a little more – the surgery is one thing, trying to figure out who's going to pick up the kids, you know, while I'm having a heart attack. But the recovery is almost impossible. Everybody's still, and this is a kind of an evolved husband. And she ends up, I mean, I was kind of going out of her mind for her that she couldn't have a recovery. Did doctors tell you this happens? I mean, you researched this.
Doctors didn't need to tell me that happened. I've been in situations myself, whether it's recovering from a minor surgery or just, you know, I remember one day when my older daughter was a baby and I woke up in the middle of the night and my eardrum had burst and it was just horrible pain and my husband had to go to work the next day and I was home alone with her and just that, like, that feeling of, like, I just want to take care of myself, but I can't because I have to take care of this other human. And I had heard this fantasy that women have about hospital stays because it's like this one opportunity you have to go and take care of yourself and not even feel guilty about it because it's a medical necessity. But for Mary Beth, maybe the hospital stay is somewhat of a break. But getting home, she has sort of set it up so much. Everybody relies on her. Everybody is leaning on her so much that they just do not know how to be leaned on. And she does not know how to really ask for that help or accept it or feel entitled to it.
I think one of your characters even says, oh, yeah, the surgery to get mom, you know, out of the house for a little while. So there's that. Some women, you know, begging to get into the hospital to get out of the house. But on the other hand, women not paying attention when they're obviously having a heart attack. I mean, when the film is made, and I'm betting it will be, I can just hear a narrator voiceover reading your words. And in fact, Mary Beth did not even know that at that moment, her heart tissue had begun to die from lack of oxygen.
You know, it's not obvious, though, with women. I think that's why heart attack is such a killer among women, because it doesn't necessarily feel like this. I think we all have this idea of this classic, like you have the pain in your left arm and you clutch it and then you pass out. And for a lot of women, it's just this sort of nausea that comes on, or it's this low-grade pain. And that combined with some of our tendency, my tendency, obviously, to rationalize it all away, it can be very dangerous.
Right. Well, she, as we said, does finally realize and then just runs away. She's had it and goes to Pittsburgh to find her birth mother. Obviously, you did some work here, too, about just how hard that can be, but the organizations that exist and the counselors that help.
Well, there was two elements of that. I mean, one of that is sort of a research that I did just as a mother. My youngest daughter is adopted, and I started to see, particularly with her, but I imagine that this is not uncommon, this emotional wound around, why did my mother leave me? And even if you have an answer to that, emotionally, I'm not sure you can ever have an answer to that. So then I started doing some research in Pittsburgh, and I called up one of the sort of oldest existing adoption agencies there, and had a woman there who helped me out and told me kind of all about the process there. And then there's sort of things that are real that you couldn't really make up, such as the fact that it's called the Orphans Court, which things like that are just so shocking that they could only be true.
Well, and this takes us back to how this is nothing like Kramer versus Kramer, because while she takes off, her husband, and I don't want to give too much away, but it's a very different story. He's more evolved, he's angry, he's upset, but there's some understanding.
I hope that readers will have a different view of Jason when they finish the book as when they start the book. And I think that, yes, he is indicative of husbands and fathers today, where they are much more involved. And yet there's still this gap and this expectation that the default parent and the worrier in chief and the person that just kind of carries the emotional load, who does the emotional work of the family, is still the mother. So Jason being who he is, when Mary Beth is not there, you kind of find out what happens, but you don't really know for most of the book because you are squarely with Mary Beth. So all you have are her fantasies and her fears about what's going on. And those range from everybody's falling apart to perhaps even worse, they're all doing fine without her.
Right. Perhaps even worse. Gail Forman, the book again is Leave Me. Gail, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Gail Forman, speaking with us last September, Leave Me is now out in paperback. And you might remember when we first aired the story, Cynthia Ravitsky heard it in Ohio and realized she was experiencing the symptoms that we were describing. So Cynthia drove herself to the hospital, found out she was indeed having a heart attack. You can hear that story at hereandnow.org. But we wanted to let you know, she tells us she's doing well. And if you're listening now, having those symptoms, follow her lead.
Do you still get a paper delivered to your doorstep every morning? Well, congratulations, you're part of a hardy minority because just 2 in 10 American adults get their news from physical print newspapers these days. That's according to a survey by the Pew Research Center just released last week. And it also showed, no surprise here, that there's a continued increase in news consumption online, almost 40%. The shift has placed a lot of power and revenue in the hands of tech giants Google and Facebook. But there's a new push to change that, and it's led by the News Media Alliance, a trade group which includes the New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, and thousands of other organizations. For more, let's go to our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Peter Kafka is senior editor of For Media at Recode. Peter, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Now, this began with an op-ed published in the Wall Street Journal by the head of the News Media Alliance. What did he say?
He said basically, we need some leverage. The newspaper publishers of the world for a decade or more have been saying, boy, we really need better terms from first Google and then Facebook. We can't get them on our own. If one of us decides we don't want to participate in the Google ecosystem or the Facebook ecosystem, we get replaced by everybody else. We'd like the power to bargain collectively, just like a worker would with their boss, except this time the boss is Google and Facebook.
Oh, interesting. And he says that in order to do that, the News Media Alliance wants an antitrust exemption from Congress. Now, what exactly would that mean?
It means they could do that. Generally, you're prohibited from getting big groups of industry leaders from acting in concert together. That creates monopolies, oligopolies. And there's laws to prevent that. So the Washington Post, New York Times, small newspapers can't get together right now and say, here's our plan. Here's how we're going to approach Google. Here's how we're going to approach Facebook. And they certainly can't tell Google or Facebook, we're going to act in concert together. They want the ability to do that.
Oh, and so they're saying that they have to form essentially
a union.
Yeah. Because what Google and Facebook, they call those two companies a digital duopoly, right?
Right. Yeah, that's the idea.
Yeah. So exactly how much control does Google and Facebook have on how much people consume news?
Hard to quantify that. I mean, everyone has a sense that everyone's sort of consuming their news digitally. If you work at a digital publisher, again, for the last decade or so, you've been orienting the way you do business around first pleasing Google, making sure that your stuff is discoverable by Google, that Google directs traffic to you. And then over the last 5 years, Facebook has become as important and now more important than Google. And you're trying to please those two masters. And if they favor you, if they send traffic your way, it can be a fire hose of traffic. It can bump your numbers up significantly. And if you're ignored in some ways, your stories won't ever sort of show up for many readers.
Mm. So there's the question of Google and Facebook not controlling, but being the gatekeepers for access.
Gatekeepers, yeah. They're the industry parlance is discovery, right? That's how you learn about a story is because Facebook or Google will help you learn about it,
and
discover it.
So what about the revenue side of things? How much money are we talking about here?
That's a little easier to quantify, and that's pretty brutal. Facebook and Google get about 77-80 cents of each new digital dollar that's spent in advertising over the next year or so. So it leaves almost nothing for really everyone else.
80% essentially?
Yep. And that's of new spending. It's not overall spending. But any growth is going to Google and Facebook, and it's leaving everyone else sort of begging for the scraps. It's hard to see sort of how the publishers can rectify that even through bargaining, but this is their attempt to even get some kind of leverage back. They feel they have none right now.
Yeah, but on the other hand, I mean, Google and Facebook would say that we are living in a digital world right now. And in fact, it's because of these companies and the access that they give users to news and information that perhaps they've done a great deal to support journalism and put more journalism in front of people than maybe otherwise would have seen it.
I think there are many people at Google and Facebook who mean well and believe they're genuinely helping the newspaper industry. I think a lot of them, they're too tactful to say it now, but think those industries have been really slow to change and slow to adapt to a digital world, and they're sort of archaic and stodgy in the way they do business. They would like to help them. They also, again, as you said at the beginning, they've opened up the world to a lot of people. So in a lot of ways, you can argue that this is a golden age for journalism, certainly for lots of readers around the world have access to news and information they never would have seen before. Where that falls down is lots of pockets of especially local, mid-sized newspapers where they're not equipped to compete economically. And they're shrinking and shrinking and shrinking. So if you're in a small town, if you're in a mid-sized town in Minneapolis, say, you're getting less and less resources every day in terms of people delivering you news.
Okay, so I have to ask you another question about that since
sure.
You mentioned local journalism. Because last week, there was also this news that Google is awarding the Press Association $800,000 to build software that would automate writing some 30,000 local stories a month, essentially putting artificial intelligence to work for local news. What more do we know about that? We just got a couple seconds here.
It's a pilot project. By the way, you're already getting robots writing, creating news for you. If you read stuff from the Associated Press, they're doing earnings reports and box scores from baseball games. Robots are already doing some news. The less scary version of that is that frees up journalists to do more interesting news. If a robot can do it, maybe a human shouldn't be writing that sort of news. And that's, I think that in Google's case, they're hoping to surface interesting stories for those writers.
Well, listeners, I can confirm to you right now that we are still flesh and blood. Having this conversation.
There's a human being on this side, at least I can vouch.
Peter, thanks so much. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I am Meghna Chakrabarty, Homo Sapien.
I'm Robin Young, same. Here Now.